Chapter 7. Attachment. It will not be necessary, for the purpose of this history, to follow out very closely all the adventures which occurred to Mrs. Catherine from the period when she quitted the Oogle and became the captain's lady. For although it would be just as easy to show as not that the young woman, by following the man of her heart, had only yielded to an innocent impulse, and by remaining with him for a certain period, had proved the depth and strength of her affection for him, although we might make very tender and eloquent apologies for the error of both parties, the reader might possibly be disgusted at such descriptions and such arguments, which, besides, are already done to his hand in the novel of Ernest Maltravers before mentioned. From the gentleman's manner towards Mrs. Catherine, and from his brilliant and immediate success, the reader will doubtless have concluded, in the first place, that Gustavus Adolphus had not a very violent affection for Mrs. Cat, in the second place, that he was a professional lady killer, and therefore likely at some period to resume his profession. Thirdly, and to conclude, that a connection so begun must, in the nature of things, be likely to end speedily. And so, to do the Count justice, it would, if he had been allowed to follow his own inclination entirely, for as many young gentlemen will, and yet no praise to them, in about a week he began to be indifferent, in a month to be weary, in 2 months to be angry, in 3 to proceed to blows and curses, and, in short, to repent most bitterly the hour when he had ever been induced to present Mrs. Catherine the toe of his boot, for the purpose of lifting her onto his horse. "Egad," said he to the corporal one day, when confiding his griefs to Mr. Brock, "I wish my toe had been cut off before ever it served as a ladder to this little vixen. Or perhaps your honor would wish to kick her downstairs with it," delicately suggested Mr. Brock. "Kick her? Why, the wench would hold so fast by the banisters that I could not kick her down, Mr. Brock. To tell you a bit of a secret, I have tried as much not to kick her, no, not kick her, certainly. That's ungentlemanly, but to induce her to go back to that cursed pothouse where we fell in with her. I have given her many hints. Oh, yes, I saw your honor give her one yesterday with a mug of beer. By the laws, as the ale run all down her face, and she clutched a knife to run at you, I don't think I ever saw such a she-devil. That woman will do for your honor someday, if you provoke her." "Do for me? No, hang it, Mr. Brock, never. She loves every hair of my head, sir. She worships me, corporal. Egad, yes. She worships me, and would much sooner apply a knife to her own weasen than scratch my little finger." "I think she does," said Mr. Brock. "I'm sure of it," said the captain. "Omen, look you, are like dogs, they like to be ill-treated. They like it, sir, I know they do. I never had anything to do with a woman in my life, but I ill-treated her, and she liked me the better." "Mrs. Hall ought to be very fond of you then, sure enough," said Mr. Corporal. "Very fond, ha, ha. Corporal, you wagyu, and so she is very fond. Yesterday, after the knife and beer scene, no wonder I threw the liquor in her face. It was so devilish flat that no gentleman could drink it. And I told her never to draw it till dinner time. Oh, it was enough to put an angel in a fury," said Brock. "Well, yesterday, after the knife business, when you had got the carver out of her hand, off she flings to her bedroom, will not eat a bit of dinner forsooth, and remains locked up for a couple of hours. At 2 o'clock afternoon, I was over a tankard, out comes the little she-devil, her face pale, her eyes bleared, and the tip of her nose as red as fire with sniffling and weeping, making for my hand. 'Max, apostrophe,' says she, 'will you forgive me?' 'Apostrophe what?' 'Apostrophe,' says I, 'forgive a murderess?' 'Apostrophe, apostrophe,' says one. 'No, curse me, never. Apostrophe, your cruelty will kill me, apostrophe,' sobbed she. 'Cruelty be hanged. Apostrophe,' says I, 'didn't you draw that beer an hour before dinner? ... She could say nothing to this, you know, and I swore that every time she did so, I would fling it into her face again. Whereupon back she flounced to her chamber, where she wept and stormed until nighttime. When you forgave her. I did forgive her, that's positive. You see, I had supped at the Rose along with Tom Trippett, and half a dozen pretty fellows, and I had eased a great fat-headed Warwickshire land junker, what do you call him? Squire, of 40 pieces, and I'm devilish good-humored when I've won, and so cat and I made it up. But I've taught her never to bring me stale beer again, ha, ha. This conversation will explain, a great deal better than any description of ours, however eloquent, the state of things, as between Count Maximilian and Mrs. Catherine, and the feelings which they entertained for each other. The woman loved him, that was the fact. And, as we have shown in the previous chapter how John Hayes, a mean-spirited fellow as ever breathed, in respect of all other passions a pygmy, was in the passion of love a giant, and followed Mrs. Catherine with a furious longing which might seem at the first, to be foreign to his nature, in the like manner, and playing at cross purposes, Mrs. Hall had become smitten of the captain, and, as he said truly, only liked him the better for the brutality which he received at his hands. For it is my opinion, madam, that love is a bodily infirmity, from which humankind can no more escape than from smallpox, and which attacks every one of us, from the first duke in the peerage down to Jack Ketch inclusive, which has no respect for rank, virtue, or roguery in man, but sets each in his turn in a fever, which breaks out the deuce knows how, or why, and, raging its appointed time, fills each individual of the one sex with a blind fury, and longing for some one of the other who may be pure, gentle, blue-eyed, beautiful, and good, or vile, shrewish, squinting, hunchbacked, and hideous, according to circumstances and luck, which dies away, perhaps, in the natural course, if left to have its way, but which contradiction causes to rage more furiously than ever. Is not history, from the Trojan War upwards and downwards, full of instances of such strange inexplicable passions? Was not Helen, by the most moderate calculation, 90 years of age, when she went off with His Royal Highness Prince Paris of Troy? Was not Madame Lavalliere ill-made, blear-eyed, tallow-complexioned, scraggy, and with hair like tow? Was not Wilkes the ugliest, charmingest, most successful man in the world? Such instances might be carried out so as to fill a volume, but cubic I bono? Love is fate, and not will, its origin not to be explained, its progress irresistible. And the best proof of this may be, had at Bow Street any day, where if you ask any officer of the establishment how they take most thieves, he will tell you at the houses of the women. They must see the dear creatures, though they hang for it, they will love, though they have their necks in the halter. And with regard to the other position, that ill usage on the part of the man does not destroy the affection of the woman, have we not numberless police reports showing how, when a bystander would beat a husband for beating his wife, man and wife fall together on the interloper and punish him for his meddling? These points, then, being settled to the satisfaction of all parties, the reader will not be disposed to question the assertion that Mrs. Hall had a real affection for the gallant Count, and grew, as Mr. Brock was pleased to say, like a beefsteak, more tender as she was thumped. Poor thing, poor thing! His flashy airs and smart looks had overcome her in a single hour, and no more is wanted to plunge into love over head and ears. No more is wanted to make a first love with, and a woman's first love lasts forever. A man's 24th, or 25th is perhaps the best, : you can't kill it, do what you will, it takes root, and lives and even grows, never mind what the soil may be in which it is planted, or the bitter weather it must bear, often as one has seen a wallflower grow out of a stone. In the first weeks of their union, the Count had at least been liberal to her. As he had a horse and fine clothes, and received abroad some of those flattering attentions which he held at such high price. He had, however, some ill luck at play, or had been forced to pay some bills, or had some other satisfactory reason for being poor, and his establishment was very speedily diminished. He argued that, as Mrs. Catherine had been accustomed to wait on others all her life, she might now wait upon herself and him. And when the incident of the beer arose, as he had been for some time employed as the Count's housekeeper, with unlimited superintendence over his comfort, his cellar, his linen, and such matters as bachelors are delighted to make over to active female hands. To do the poor wretch justice, she actually kept the man's meanage in the best order. Nor was there any point of extravagance with which she could be charged, except a little extravagance of dress displayed on the very few occasions when he condescended to walk abroad with her, and extravagance of language and passion in the frequent quarrels they had together. Perhaps in such a connection as subsisted between this precious couple, these faults are inevitable on the part of the woman. She must be silly and vain, and will pretty surely therefore be fond of dress, and she must, disguise it as she will, be perpetually miserable and brooding over her fall, which will cause her to be violent and quarrelsome. Such, at least, was Mrs. Hall, and very early did the poor vain misguided wretch begin to reap what as he had sown. For a man, remorse under these circumstances is perhaps uncommon. No stigma affixes on him for betraying a woman, no bitter pangs of mortified vanity, no insulting looks of superiority from his neighbor, and no sentence of contemptuous banishment is read against him. These all fall on the tempted, and not on the tempter, who is permitted to go free. The chief thing that a man learns after having successfully practiced on a woman is to despise the poor wretch whom he has won. The game, in fact, and the glory, such as it is all his, and the punishment alone falls upon her. Consider this, ladies, when charming young gentlemen come to woo you with soft speeches. You have nothing to win, except wretchedness, and scorn, and desertion. Consider this, and be thankful to your Solomons for telling it. It came to pass, then, that the Count had come to have a perfect contempt and indifference for Mrs. Hall. How should he not for a young person who had given herself up to him so easily, and would have been quite glad of any opportunity of parting with her? But there was a certain lingering shame about the man, which prevented him from saying at once and abruptly, "Go." And the poor thing did not choose to take such hints as fell out in the course of their conversation and quarrels. And so they kept on together, he treating her with simple insult, and she hanging on desperately, by whatever feeble twig she could find, to the rock beyond which all was not, or death, to her. Well, after the night with Tom Trippett, and the pretty fellows at the Rose, to which we have heard the Count allude in the conversation just recorded, fortune smiled on him a good deal, for the Warwickshire squire, who had lost 40 pieces on that occasion, insisted on having his revenge the night after, when, strange to say, 150 more found their way into the pouch of His Excellency the Count. Such a sum as this quite set the young nobleman afloat again, and brought back a pleasing equanimity to his mind, which had been a good deal disturbed in the former difficult circumstances. And in this, for a little, and to a certain extent, poor Cat had the happiness to share. He did not alter the style of his establishment, which consisted, as before, of herself and a small person who acted as scourer, kitchen wench, and scullion, Mrs. Catherine always putting her hand to the principal pieces of the dinner. But he treated his mistress with tolerable good humor, or, to speak more correctly, with such bearable brutality as might be expected from a man like him to a woman in her condition. Besides, a certain event was about to take place, which not unusually occurs in circumstances of this nature, and Mrs. Catherine was expecting soon to lie in. The captain, distrusting naturally the strength of his own paternal feelings, had kindly endeavored to provide a parent for the coming infant, and to this end had opened a negotiation with our friend Mr. Thomas Bullock, declaring that Mrs. Cat should have a fortune of 20 guineas, and reminding Thomas of his ancient flame for her. But Mr. Thomas, when this proposition was made to him, declined it, with many oaths, and vowed that he was perfectly satisfied with his present bachelor condition. In this dilemma, Mr. Brock stepped forward, who declared himself very ready to accept Mrs. Catherine and her fortune, and might possibly have become the possessor of both, had not Mrs. Cat, the moment she heard of the proposed arrangement, with fire in her eyes, and rage, oh, how bitter, in her heart, prevented the success of the measure, by proceeding incontinently to the first justice of the peace, and there swearing before his worship who was the father of the coming child. This proceeding, which as he had expected would cause not a little indignation on the part of her lord and master, was received by him, strangely enough, with considerable good humor. He swore that the wench had served him a good trick, and was rather amused at the anger, the outbreak of fierce rage and contumely, and the wretched tears of heartsick desperation, which followed her announcement of this step to him. For Mr. Brock, she repelled his offer with scorn and loathing, and treated the notion of a union with Mr. Bullock with yet fiercer contempt. Marry him indeed! A workhouse pauper carrying a brown Bess! She would have died sooner, she said, or robbed on the highway. And so, to do her justice, she would. For the little minx was one of the vainest creatures in existence, and vanity, as I presume everybody knows, becomes the principal in certain women's hearts, their moral spectacles, their conscience, their meat and drink, their only rule of right and wrong. As for Mr. Thomas, he, as we have seen, was quite unfriendly to the proposition as she could be, and the corporal, with a good deal of comical gravity, vowed that, as he could not be satisfied in his dearest wishes, he would take to drinking for a consolation, which he straightway did. "Come, Thomas," said he to Mr. Bullock, "since we can't have the girl of our hearts, why, hang it, Thomas, let's drink her health." To which Bullock had no objection. And so strongly did the disappointment weigh upon honest Corporal Brock, that even when, after unheard of quantities of beer, he could scarcely utter a word, he was seen absolutely to weep, and, in accents almost unintelligible, to curse his confounded ill luck at being deprived, not of a wife, but of a child. He wanted one so, he said, to comfort him in his old age. The time of Mrs. Catherine's couch drew near, arrived, and was gone through safely. She presented to the world a shopping boy, who might use, if he liked, the Galgenstein arms with a bar sinister, and in her new cares and duties had not so many opportunities as usual of quarreling with the Count, who, perhaps, respected her situation, or, at least, was so properly aware of the necessity of quiet to her, that he absented himself from home morning, noon, and night. The captain had, it must be confessed, turned these continued absences to a considerable worldly profit, for he played incessantly, and, since his first victory over the Warwickshire squire, fortune had been so favorable to him, that he had at various intervals amassed a sum of nearly £1,000, which he used to bring home as he won, and which he deposited in a strong iron chest, cunningly screwed down by himself under his own bed. This Mrs. Catherine regularly made, and the treasure underneath it could be no secret to her. However, the noble Count kept the key, and bound her by many solemn oaths that he discharged at her himself, not to reveal to any other person the existence of the chest and its contents. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.